Welcome to the CLDF GAP PBC podcast series. My name is Andrea Gossard. I am your host for today. We are excited to have you here with us for our first episode of an eight-part series. Join us as we dive deep into the intricacies of primary biliary cholangitis, exploring various aspects of the disease. We hope you'll follow along with us throughout the entire podcast series. In today's episode, we will explore the significance of using biomarkers such as alkaline phosphatase to monitor primary biliary cholangitis. We will examine the utility in assessing therapy response and disease progression. We will also review how they collectively impact personalized treatment plans for PBC. Joining me today is Christina Hansen, a family nurse practitioner and a fellow GAP board member. Christina is a highly respected expert and a professional in the field of hepatology. Welcome, Christina.
Thanks, Andrea. I'm happy to be a part of this kickoff episode for the series.
Excellent. Together, we aim to provide a comprehensive understanding of the various biomarkers beyond alkaline phosphatase to monitor PBC, their utility in assessing ursodeoxycholic acid therapy response, and to determine disease progression. We will also look at how they collectively work to enhance personalized treatment plans through continuous monitoring and advanced strategies. Let's get started, Christina. Welcome to the show. So for starters, let's talk a little bit about what kinds of blood tests you typically do to monitor PBC, the response to therapy, and evidence of disease progression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. We've got an established diagnosis at this point. I think we clearly, historically have followed the alkaline phosphatase closely for monitoring. I think we do recognize that total bilirubin is also very, very important, and there's been some updates on recommendations of where to keep these levels or drive to, obtain adequate response. We talk about response versus adequate response and this kind of the shift in the way that we want to drive that alkaline phos into the normal range. And there's data and studies around, keeping that bilirubin under 0.6. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But there are a range of serum biomarkers that we can use as indicators for disease progression. And I think it's important to not just focus on alkaline phosphatase alone and the bilirubin, but we recognize that ALT, AST are important as well. There is some data around following GGT, whether, that's kind of gotten traction across the country or we're doing that on the regular, but certainly there's some data around really any excursions outside of the upper limit of normal, could be associated with poorer outcomes. So liver panel, certainly, I know in another podcast series, we're going to talk about some of the extrahepatic manifestations and other things that we'll be looking at there. But as far as for treatment response, it's usually those biomarkers. We tend to see ALT, AST elevations milder than the alkaline phosphatase at time of diagnosis. That can be indicative of hepatocellular injury and inflammation. We recognize that alkaline phosphatase and GGT are more cholestatic markers. So I think, we want to look at the whole picture. And certainly when we're looking at more advanced disease, that's when we get a little concerned when that bilirubin is rising. But keeping in mind other, synthetic function of the liver, low albumin, low platelets, then we're, obviously getting concerned for advanced disease with cirrhosis. So I think you have to kind of take in the whole picture when it comes to the biomarkers. And I know we'll talk a little bit about fibrosis as a prognostic marker as well.
Thank you. So walk me through what you might do when you're first starting a patient on treatment with ursodeoxycholic acid or potentially using an adjunct therapy to ursodeoxycholic acid. What do you do with assessing baseline parameters and then really looking for response over time?
Yeah, so definitely I want to get all those baseline labs. And I think it's important to just as a caveat, a lot of times these patients come to us with elevated liver function tests, referred in for workup for that. And not necessarily an established diagnosis of PBC, but even if there is an established diagnosis and I don't know that history, I want to make sure I'm also ruling out other potential underlying liver diseases and not just assuming that this is just PBC that I'm dealing with. So I think, again, it's really important to make sure you're getting that additional serologic workup to rule out iron overload, check the viral serologies, make sure that there's no potential for overlap with autoimmune hepatitis. So getting all those markers, make sure you know that this is what you're dealing with, vaccination for hepatitis A and B, if this patient hasn't had that established. So then I have my baseline blood work and notably these biomarkers that we're talking about. I definitely want to get a baseline fibrosis assessment. In my practice, we're fortunate to have a FibroScan. So we typically utilize FibroScan really on all patients with liver disease, PBC included, to get that baseline. Because we recognize, the literature has shown us that fibrosis stage alone, independent of biomarkers, so you can have a normal alkaline phosphatase, but if you have more advanced fibrosis, independent of those changes in biochemical markers, it very much is a prognostic marker and can be predictive of poor outcomes with more advanced disease. So getting that baseline so that I can periodically reassess that as well. And then initiating weight-based URSO at time of diagnosis. I tend to want to hear from my patient within those first few weeks, tolerability. And then I tend to like to pull blood work about 3 months. There may be, if there's more concern, other comorbidities, or, more advanced liver disease, there may be an indication to pull that sooner. But kind of as a standard, I want to look at what's happening at that three-month mark and really watch those trends probably every 3 months over that first year. And if I'm not seeing, really by that year mark, a good response, and I've got them on an adequate dose of URSO. So there is some subtherapeutic dosing that, we've had discussion around that maybe people aren't maximizing even the URSO before they're making changes or adding second line therapy. But I would say about that year mark, if I'm not seeing the levels that I want, which really for me is that benchmark of getting alkaline phosphatase to the normal range, then that's where I may be considering second line therapy. Now, if I do have a patient with more aggressive disease, meaning more aggressive fibrosis, more advanced fibrosis, there may be an indication to consider initiating second line therapy sooner.
So let's go back a little bit. You had commented earlier about sort of the biochemistries and which ones you're kind of looking at. So we know alkaline phosphatase is one that people tend to hone in the setting of PBC. What do you think the utility is of monitoring the ALT and AST as well? Are they, when you're determining whether or not to add another therapy or determining whether or not the patient is a responder, how much do you use those variables in that decision versus the alkaline phosphatase?
Yeah, I think still in practice, I tend to really watch that alk phos. If I have a normal alkaline phosphatase, and it's interesting that you bring this up because it was a discussion we were having actually just yesterday with a group of KOLs, APPs, and PBC, but, fairly significant elevations of AST, ALT, and a normal alkaline phosphatase. That's something I actually would be a little bit more concerned. Is there something else going on? We know by ASLD guidelines, we don't require liver biopsy for diagnosis. There are certain histologic findings for PBC if they do get a liver biopsy that are consistent. But if we've got that elevated ALK phos or AMA positivity, then that can be diagnostic and we don't need the liver biopsy. But in a case like a normal ALK phos in a patient with PBC that have fairly high transaminases, there may be indication to look at that further and go to the tissue to see what's going on. I may do a liver biopsy. But I actually had some, statistics, some studies, that I jotted down to share. But there actually is a real-world retrospective analysis of over 3,500 patients with PBC looking at risk of hospitalization for any kind of hepatic decompensation, transplant, et cetera, and looking at the magnitude of elevation of not only alkaline phosphatase, but ALT and AST as well as GGT, and the duration of time that these levels remain outside of that, these derangements or excursions. And actually thresholds above upper limit of normal for alkaline phosphatase, but also ALT and AST were actually found to be associated with increased risk of adverse outcomes. And in fact, any increase above the upper limit of normal confers some additional risk, some incremental risk. So again, what we do with this, when we go out and practice in the real world remains to be seen, but I think it's helpful to have this data and to understand. There was actually a separate observational study demonstrating that GGT can also be used to identify patients with PBC at risk for liver transplantation. And we recognize that, you know, bilirubin, there's been quite a lot of data around the bilirubin, even in the normal range, but as low as just above 0.6 can still be an incremental risk. So making sure that we try to keep that threshold of bilirubin less than 0.6. So if I have a bili that's 0.7 and an ALT, AST, they're just barely above the upper limit normal, am I going to add second line therapy? You know, I think understanding this, recognizing what the data is showing, but I think it still comes down to looking at that patient in front of you. What are their additional risks around this patient? How long have you had them on first-line therapy? You know, is there a chance that they're going to declare themselves more or drop, have those levels drop more? Is there some secondary, you know, unfortunately, PBC population of patients historically have been, you know, a fairly lean middle-aged women, but with the rise in MASH, you know, we definitely could have a secondary assault there with steatosis in the liver. So making sure we look at that whole picture. If they have more advanced disease, though, as far as advanced stages of fibrosis, then I may be a little bit more concerned, especially if those excursions are higher, understanding what this data is now suggesting.
Which is really interesting and a shift. I've worked with PBC for many years, and there was a time where we were simply looking for some reduction in the alkaline phosphatase. So these more aggressive guidelines and goals really are a shift in therapy and how best to manage these patients. You've alluded to it a few times, and you know we both are aware of the fact that you know we rarely need to perform a liver biopsy at baseline to make the diagnosis. It certainly is not considered sort of standard practice to perform periodic biopsies to assess for sort of stage of disease, but we're much quicker to use the sort of by the bedside fiber scans that we're able to have access to. Tell me a little bit about how you factor in the information associated with level of fibrosis, not necessarily level of steatosis, but level of fibrosis when you're determining treatment for PBC.
Yeah. So again, I think in more recent literature, we know as an independent prognostic marker, fibrosis is important. And there actually is data around with more advanced stages of fibrosis, even with what we would maybe say adequate response to URSO, they do have reduced transplant-free survival percentages. So again, keeping that in mind, especially if I have a fibrosis stage 3, and you know I'm seeing that alkaline phosphatase in a decent range, but I've got that concern around that fibrosis, and maybe I am seeing some of those other biochemical markers that are going up and down a little bit. That may be someone that I'm going to have a little bit closer conversation with, knowing again that data. I mean, a majority of time, you know, this patient population, especially if we can get them identified early, they're fairly manageable. It's a fairly slowly progressing disease, but in other phenotypes, you know, these patients can progress, you know, a stage of fibrosis every year to year and a half. I mean, it can go both directions. So I think we have to kind of look at this data and look at that patient in front of us and decide, you know, what might be the best approach when they're having more advanced stages of fibrosis. We've actually, again, I've got some data around an international retrospective study that looked at over 2,200 patients with compensated PBC on URSO. And the adjusted relative risk of serious clinical events in these patients that had increased fibrosis as per liver stiffness measurement on FibroScan. And any increase actually in the liver stiffness measure was associated with significant increased risk of serious clinical event, again, independent of prognostic biochemical markers, and actually was considered to be correlated with an inadequate response to URSO. A separate study found that those advanced stages of F3, F4, based on histologic assessment, actually, for liver biopsy, was an independent predictor of transplant-free survival. So as a major prognostic marker in PBC, fibrosis certainly can be utilized to assess that need for second-line therapy. And again, I think we're going to continue to see that shift from just looking at that alkaline phosphatase independent of everything else and try to bring in that whole picture when we're assessing these patients. I think, at least in the world that is a little bit more familiar with PBC, and you can probably speak to this being the absolute expert in this, I think we at least have, in that realm, have adopted the idea and agree with driving alkaline phosphatase to the normal range and trying to keep that bili in that range as well. But that's it, at the upper echelons of understanding and knowledge around PBC. When we get into the general community, general GI, I think there's still a lot of education that needs to be done around that. These patients tend to be fairly asymptomatic. We're going to talk about, you know, the extra hepatic manifestations they have and management later in the series, but they're pretty reasonable individuals. I'd like to say a middle-aged woman is a compliant patient, since I'm right in that realm. But at the same time, they can get lost to follow-up. Mm-hmm. And so if providers aren't aware and they saw an ELF-FOS that went from 600 to 250, that's a response. But in today's day and age, we recognize that's not adequate. So I still think that is a huge message that we still need to be educating and at least getting an understanding of these other biomarkers. And these small excursions outside of the upper limit of normal, plus the duration of time, you know, the level and the time that they're there. That's good data to have. It's going to, I think, take some traction before we see that really starting to dictate how we manage patients. But I think it's really compelling and really important for us to recognize, for sure. And we know that they can go independently, right? We know that the alkaline phosphatase can normalize, but an AST and ALT might be in the abnormal ranges. So they don't all go in conjunction. So it is a little bit trickier.
One last question for you today. If you had to sort of determine, you know, what would be the best timeline to really sort of identify a patient as either a responder or not? Do you use 6 months, 12 months, 2 years? You know, there are multiple different guidelines out there. And so I'm curious what you use in practice.
Yeah. Again, I think it's a discussion around what your patient's goals are. I would really like to see within that, I would like to see the continued downtrend over time over that first year. Again, maybe considering more aggressive intervention at 6 months if I have a patient with fairly advanced stages of fibrosis. And again, that's a discussion I'll have with that patient at time of diagnosis. But if I see a fairly continued steady trend, and by 1 year, I'm, you know, really getting close to that, you know, normal range, upper limit of normal, I may give that patient a little bit more time to declare themselves in response to treatment and look again, taking in mind the fibrosis stage. If they're zero, you know, F0 to 1 liver stiffness on FibroScan, maybe I'll give them a little bit more time. Because I think you also ultimately have to think about a second medication that this patient is taking, potential side effects with another medication on board. That they'll be on long term, and you have to think about cost. So you have to think about the safety, the cost, and what the patient's able to do, and compliance, and all that when it comes to that. So there may be a little wiggle room to give them a little bit more time, but I would say I'd like to look around that year mark.
Excellent, thank you. As we wrap up today's conversation, I want to thank you, Christina, for joining us and for all of your insights and expertise. It was wonderful having you on the show. I look forward to being on a future podcast as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Andrew. I think these are important topics, you know, to talk about, and excited to see this series roll out.
Thank you.